Radio Fortis Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today we will continue listening to Tangent's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. Please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello once more to our program, and I hope your week has been fruitful and happy. Last week in our exploration of the chapter on meditation in Shantideva's A Guide to the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, we came to the somewhat masochistic-sounding verses that read, "By further describing the renown of others, I should make it outshine my own. Just like the lowest kind of servant, I should employ myself for the benefit of all. I should not praise my naturally fault-ridden self for some temporary good quality it may have. I shall never let even a few people know of any good qualities I may possess. In brief, for the sake of living creatures, may all the harms I have selfishly caused to others descend upon me myself." Now, I must admit that I do find Shantideva's attitude to himself here harsh, even though Pema Chodron, in her commentary, says that he's not being masochistic. Kunzang Paldin's explanation, however, is translated by the Padmakara translation group and therefore follows that group's translation of the Shantideva text. And that is much more explicit about the difference between the person and the ego. It reads, "This ego is by nature rife with defects. Its accidental talents I should hide, not praise. Whatever qualities it has, I will conceal, that they remain unknown to everyone. All the harm, in short, my ego does to its advantage and to others' cost, may all of it descend upon itself, to its own hurt, to others' benefit." And Kunzen Paldin comments, "This baneful ego is by nature full of faults. Whatever rare talents it has, successful activities, learning, intelligence, meditative practice and retreat, are purely accidental. We should keep quiet about them, almost as if they were stolen goods, so that no one knows about them. We should never make use of them as a means to improve our situation. As the Buddha advised his disciples, do not advertise your good qualities, do not conceal your faults. In short, we should make the wish that all the damage we've done from time without beginning in trying to get advantage for ourselves in the way of fame, possessions, and so on, at others' cost, through theft and so forth, should descend entirely upon us. May we be injured, and may others benefit. In brief, as it has been said, we must purify our karmic debts and repay what we owe." Now, my understanding is first that whatever talents we have, ego-based or not, come from positive karma. In other words, positive actions we've done in the past, so they're not purely accidental. "It's accidental talents" is a strange translation, for a Buddhist would not claim anything to be accidental when the mainstay of the Buddhist teachings is the law of cause and effect. The Stephen Batchelor translation, "some temporary good quality," seems more in keeping with general Buddhist teachings. And also, if one can purify karma as is claimed, why pray for our negative deeds to ripen on us and cause intense suffering? If the suffering is to descend on the ego, while we are ego-driven beings, it will necessarily descend on ourselves. Why not rather pray that the negative karma is completely purified, so that neither we nor anyone else suffers at all? This seems to me a much more compassionate approach than negatively coming down on oneself for actions that often were dictated by conditioning and afflictive emotions we had little control over. And if we take such a judgmental stance towards ourselves, why then shouldn't we do so towards others and say, may all the harms others have selfishly caused to beings other than themselves descend upon them? That is truly not compassionate. And can we have a double standard that works differently for oneself and for others? I don't think so. I'm very much more in favor of a more organic and gentler explanation by Thich Nhat Hanh that has relevance, I think, to these verses. The website Daring to Live Fully describes how, taking the example of his hands, Thich Nhat Hanh explains that although his right hand has written many poems, his left hand hasn't written any. However, his right hand doesn't have a superiority complex. It doesn't turn to the left hand and say, I write poetry and you don't. I'm better than you are. You, left hand, are good for nothing. At the same time, his left hand doesn't have an inferiority complex. It doesn't feel bad about itself because the right hand writes poetry and it does not. He goes on to say that he was trying to hammer a nail into the wall, but missed the nail and ended up hitting the thumb on his left hand with a hammer. His right hand immediately put down the hammer and held the left hand very tenderly, as if it was taking care of itself. The right hand did not then say to the left hand, remember that I, the right hand, have taken good care of you. You have to pay me back sometime in the future. At the same time, the left hand didn't say, right hand, you've done me a great harm. Give me the hammer. I want justice. The two hands know that they're together. They know that they're in each other's care. In the same way, when we can move beyond our self-absorption and connect deeply with others, we know that whatever happens, we are in each other's care. That, I think, is the real point, that we have to recognize that we are all in each other's care. So acting selfishly or arrogantly not only harms others, but also ourselves. And if we didn't recognize this in the past, but do now, it benefits nobody to say, let all my negative karma ripen upon me. Rather, wouldn't it be better to completely purify that karma and stop acting selfishly? As I said before, in that way, nobody needs suffer greatly anymore because of those negative deeds, even though due to them, beings may have suffered in the past. In any case, the work of a Buddhist is not to cause or experience more suffering, but to destroy the very cause of suffering, which is the badly conceived self, or what Kunzang Peldon refers to as the baneful ego. Of course, we will have to put up with a certain amount of discomfort in this work. That is inevitable, but to wish misery upon oneself is not part of that, I don't think. Now, what do you think? Now, before we go on with Shantideva's text, let's set our motivation as we usually do, thinking that this program may become the cause for not only of our own enlightenment, but the enlightenment of all beings everywhere. Thank you. Shantideva continues with his theme in the next two verses. I should not be dominating and aggressive, acting in a self-righteous, arrogant way. Instead, like a newly married bride, I should be bashful, timid, and restrained. Thus, O mind, you should think and abide in this way, and not act selfishly as before. If under the control of self-cherishing you transgress this code, your selfishness will be your end. And compare this with the Padmakara group translation. Do not let it strut about the place so arrogant and overbearing, but like a newly wedded bride, let it be demure and blushing, timorous and shy. That's how it should stay. And if it lapses, bring it forcibly to heel with antidotes. And if these fail, well then, apply the lash. Well, there's quite a difference between your selfishness will be your end and, well then, apply the lash. It would be interesting to see what the original Sanskrit had. In any case, I hope you get the message that Shantideva is putting across, that we have to give up our self-cherishing attitudes, which lead to strutting about the place so arrogant and overbearing, and be more restrained. For if we continue acting with only our own good in mind, we will inevitably create the causes for our own suffering in the future. Still, I cannot really see some of the more forceful practitioners I've come across being demure, blushing, timorous and shy. Certainly, my teacher of many years ago had many, many excellent qualities, but you couldn't say he always had the aspect of a newly wedded bride. He could be quite wrathful if he thought you deserved it, and even at the monastery where he was at one time abbot, he was renowned for his scoldings. When his New Zealand translator visited the monastery, the monks asked her, "Does Kensa Rinpoche scold you New Zealand people a lot?" "No, not much," she replied. "Oh, when he was here, he was always scolding the monks," they told her. Evidently, the monks held him in some awe, even though some were much bigger than him. He was quite a small man, but had enormous energy that sometimes translated into strong action or words. He didn't scold me until I became a monk, and then, on a pilgrimage in India with him, I got it quite a few times in the neck. It must have been quite funny to onlookers. I'm 6'2" or 188 centimeters, and he must have been about 5'7" or thereabouts. This lanky, awkward Western monk being given a tongue-lashing by a small Tibetan who was very obviously very comfortable in his own skin. Rinpoche probably thought that we cosseted white New Zealanders were too weak to take a rigorous telling off, for I did some things he was quite mild about that I'm sure would have got monks at the monastery a thorough roasting if they'd done the same. In any case, we had to respect him and ourselves try to act like newly wedded brides, because we couldn't be sure he was not beyond all ego-grasping. Certainly he was much further advanced on the path than most of us were. But even humility I couldn't always achieve, so strong is the power of the ego, and I probably created some heavy negative karma in relation to him that will bite me back in due course. But now let's get back to Shantideva. He continues, "However, mind, although you have been advised, if you do not act in a like manner, then since all misfortunes will entrust themselves to you, you will only be destined to destruction. That previous time when you could overcome me is now past. Now I see your nature and your faults, and wherever you go, I shall destroy your arrogance." When we are all unaware, all our actions are based on the wrong conception of the self, which the Padmacara group calls ego. However, I'm not sure that the self the Buddha was at pains to refute is exactly what Dr. Freud and we Westerners call ego. Nevertheless, Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche has written a beautiful article on the website elephantjournal.com about this ego self and how it causes all our problems. The article goes like this. "These days, if we see someone behaving selfishly, we might say they're being egotistical. If someone thinks you have a really big ego, they may even post a blog calling you an egomaniac. From the standpoint of our mental health, it's important to have self-esteem, or what some psychologists call a healthy ego. So when we're talking with our friends and mention our ego, what do we mean? From a Buddhist point of view, the ego is something made up by the mind. It's the sense of self, a flash of I or me that we believe in and cling to. It's the basis of our feeling of self-importance. It's a story, a myth of self that we keep telling ourselves. That self is the center of our universe. No matter what we're doing, our actions always come from and reflect back to our sense of self-consciousness. This ego self we cling to is the source of most of our problems. Wherever we get hung up in pain and confusion, there we'll find the ego. The Buddha taught that the root cause of our suffering, ignorance, is what gives rise to this tendency to cling. What am I clinging to? Is the question you should ask yourself. We should look deeply at this process to see if anything is really there. According to the Buddha, we're clinging to a myth. It is just a thought that says I, repeated so often that it creates an illusory self, like a hologram that we take to be solid. With every thought, every emotion, this self appears to be more and more real, when it's actually just a fabrication of the mind. It's an ancient habit, so ingrained in us that this very clinging becomes part of our identity too. If we let go of this thought of me, we might feel that something familiar was missing, as though a close friend or a chronic pain had suddenly disappeared. Imagine that you look down at your hand one day and see that it's clenched in a fist. You sense that you're holding onto something so vital that you can't let it go. Your fist is clenched so tightly that your hand hurts. The ache in your hand travels all the way up your arm. Tension spreads throughout your body. This goes on for years. You take an aspirin now and then, or have a drink, or watch TV, or take up skydiving. Life keeps on happening. And then, one day, you forget to hold on, and your hand just opens. But when you look, there's nothing inside. Clinging to this mythical self is just like gripping an imaginary object in our hand. What does it accomplish? It only gives us a headache and ulcers, and we quickly develop many other kinds of suffering on top of that. This I becomes proactive in protecting its interests, because it immediately perceives other. The instant we have the thought of I and other, the whole drama of us versus them develops. It all happens in the blink of an eye. We desire one thing and try our best to get it. We hate or fear another and work to keep it away. And there are still other things we don't care about one way or another. What we're trying to get, ignore, or steer clear of could be a new car, our in-laws, or the state of Arizona. We play out the same patterns with belief systems and values, not just with people, places, and things. We may not care about internet neutrality, but we may be strongly pro or con on war, equal rights, or the existence of extraterrestrials. All of our neurotic emotions and judgments start with our clinging to I, me, and mine. And we're not exempt from our own judgments. We admire some of our qualities and build ourselves up. But there are other things we can't stand about ourselves, so we tear ourselves down. One minute we're feeling pretty smart and sure of ourselves, and the next minute we're feeling totally inadequate or guilty about something. We spend a great deal of time ignoring the pain we're really feeling because of this inner struggle, always striving to be happy with who we are, and never quite getting there. We expend so much effort just to convince ourselves that we found something we can call me. We try to freeze the moment-to-moment flow of experience that is our life and make something solid out of it. But somehow, it just doesn't work. Our efforts only produce more anxiety because we're going against the way things truly are. Why do we clutch our ego so tightly when the tension of holding on is so painful? We think that to give up this thought of I would be crazy. We think our life depends on it. But actually, we would feel so much better and more relaxed if we just let go. It's a tricky situation. On the one hand, the mind is fully awake and ego-free. And that's called the true nature of our mind. On the other hand, we don't see that ever-present awake quality. We don't even know that it's there. Through the practice of meditation, we become familiar with the workings of our mind and begin to experience more clarity. Then we start to see beyond the illusion of ego and glimpse the true nature of our mind. We see what it's like to be free from ego. At that moment, we're relieved from fear and anxiety about our life. This isn't some far-fetched top-of-the-mountain epiphany. When it's not clinging to ego, our mind isn't stressed out, worried, or trying to prove anything. Its attitude is, just relax and enjoy being yourself. People often ask what the experience of this true nature is like. They worry that it's like becoming a vegetable. But it's not like that at all. The mind actually functions much better. When we take a break from our habit of clinging to the ego, we see more clearly and think more clearly. We feel more alive and awake. It's a very beautiful place to be. Imagine standing on a scenic mountain peak and looking out at the world in all directions without any obstructions. That's the view of the mind, free from its obstructionist friend called ego. And that is Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche's explanation. Shantideva is making the point that to cut ourselves loose from this obstructionist friend, we have to exchange ourselves for others. In other words, exchange our self-cherishing attitude, the workings of the ego, for an attitude that cherishes others more. As those who've been with us in previous programs, that is what this whole chapter on meditation is about. And so Shantideva says in the next verse, I should immediately cast aside all thoughts to work for my own sake. By having sold you to others, I shall not become discouraged, but shall offer up all your strength to others. If, having become unconscientious, I do not give you to all living beings, it is certain that you will deliver me to the guardians of hell. For ages you have dealt with me like this, and I have suffered long. But now, recalling all my grudges, I shall overcome your selfish thoughts. Likewise, if I wish to be happy, I should not be happy with myself. And similarly, if I wish to be protected, I should constantly protect all others. If we take Dzogchen Ponlop Rinpoche's analogy of a clenched fist to mind, as long as we give in to egocentric behavior and thoughts, it is as if we are tightly clenching our fist, afraid that if we let go even slightly, we will lose something invaluable. We clench so tightly that our hand, our arm, our whole body becomes sore. And as long as we cling like this, we will just suffer more and more. However, if we are daring enough to ease off the clenching and open the hand, we have immediate relief and also realize that there was nothing to hold on to in the first place. Imagine the bliss. And anyway, as you know, an open hand is a symbol for inclusion, friendliness, and welcome. So it conveys a special meaning to these verses, and particularly to the last one. Likewise, if I wish to be happy, I should not be happy with myself. And similarly, if I wish to be protected, I should constantly protect all others. We might take as an example the Open Hand Initiative in America, an organization dedicated to improving people-to-people understanding and international friendship through exchanges and other projects that focus on our basic shared values and common humanity. Their website says, "We take what is best about our societies and share them. In doing so, we enrich each other, deepen our interdependence and respect, and build a reservoir of goodwill that can withstand even the most fundamental policy differences." Of course, this may not be individually ego-slaying, but by swapping a narrow American values for the whole world kind of attitude for an open mind willing to share and learn from others, it certainly lays a foundation for individual openness and collective protection. Where do policy differences often come from if not the egocentric mind that clings to its own point of view to the exclusion of all others? And yet, as Dzongsa Khyentse Rinpoche says, you can swap one political point of view for another, but it doesn't much alter what happens in government. Even a world war starts off with a clinging, egocentric thought. So whatever we can do to defeat such thoughts bends our minds even a little to enlightenment. Shantideva now goes on to talk about attachment to the body. To whatever degree I take great care of this body, to that degree I shall fall into a state of extreme helplessness. Having fallen in this way, if my desires are unable to be fulfilled even by everything upon this earth, what else will be able to satisfy them? Being unable to fulfill them, though, desiring to do so, disturbing conceptions and a dissatisfied mind will ensue. But if I do not depend on any material things, the exhaustion of my good fortune will be unknown. Therefore, I shall never create an opportunity for the desires of the body to increase. For whatever I do not grasp as attractive, these are the best of all possessions. Our society appears geared to satisfying the demands of the body, or what we think the body should look like. In an earlier program, I noted that according to the World Watch Institute, women in the USA spend $8 billion on cosmetics a year. Together with European women, they spend $12 billion on perfume alone. And it's not only women. According to an article in the Daily Beast, last year, American men spent $5 billion on grooming products, double what they spent in 1997. And here's something to make you smile. Advertisers have developed a whole new vocabulary to sell men's makeup. Eyebrow pencils are much too girly for blokes, Instead, guys should ask for brow and beard correctors. And foundation for men is a sculpting face stick or urban camouflage. And concealer, something that hides skin blemishes, dark circles under the eyes, discolorations, tattoos, and other bodily marks, is a confidence corrector. And evidently, that's one of the most popular products in the men's makeup range. Also, the range of foods in our supermarkets is staggering. How many breakfast cereals can you count on the shelves of your local supermarket? The choice is unbelievable. And that's true of all the types of food we have access to in first world countries. Drug companies are among the richest in the world and have such influence with governments that they practically print their own money. And it's all based on our obsession to fulfill the demands and desires of our bodies, which Shantideva points out would not be satisfied even if we had access to everything on earth. In fact, we've proved his point. For thinking everything on earth is ours to do with as we wish, we've plundered this planet almost to the point of no return, and we are still not satisfied. All we've done in the process is increase competitiveness, stubbornness, intolerance, anger, disrespect for others, and a mind that cannot find real satisfaction with anything. This body is not a vessel for happiness until we take control of its incessant demands and stop relying on material objects and wealth. The more contented we can be with what we have, the easier our life will become. Overweening ambition is the fuel for overwhelming disenchantment. I love the story of the man sitting in the sun against a wall of a house near the beach on an island. Some tourists come by and start talking to him. They ask what he did during his days, and he told them he just sat in the sun watching the sea. They ask him why he didn't get a job. "Oh, yes. What then?" he says. "Well, then you can save money and buy a house," they say. "Oh, very good. What then?" he asks. "Well, then you can put in a swimming pool," they answer. "Oh, that sounds nice. What then?" "Well, then, you can keep saving money and get rich." "Oh, okay, that sounds excellent. But what then?" "Well, then, you'll have no worries and you can sit back and relax in the sun," they say. The man just smiles at them, relaxes back against the wall, and lets the sun play on his face. And now you might argue that we can't all just find a wall to relax against in the sun, and of course to a certain extent that's true. I don't think that Shantideva is advocating that we do nothing to look after our body. Rather, he's saying that following the desires of the body will never bring satisfaction, and to the extent that we can give up such desires, to that extent we will find real contentment and peace. If we can use things without attachment, and give up the mind that is always looking for more and better, if we can look after our body so that it can be used in the service of others, we will start to find the happiness that our restless mind is always craving. And that is where we have to end up today, as time is up. Now, thanks for joining the program, and I hope you will do so again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential from the program to the enlightenment of all beings, and that, of course, includes yourself. I hope you'll join us again next week. Goodbye. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association. Respectful, beneficial, empowering.
समस्या का हल।